soul and body. Of all the more important departments of scientific knowledge, the least advanced is psychology. According to its derivation, psychology should mean the theory of the soul. But the soul, though familiar to theologians, can hardly be regarded as a scientific concept. No psychologist would say that the subject matter of his study is the soul. But when asked to say what it is, he would not find it easy to give an answer. Some would say that psychology is concerned with mental phenomena, but they would be puzzled if they were required to state in what respect, if any, mental phenomena differ from those which provide the data of physics. Fundamental psychological questions quickly take us into regions of philosophical uncertainty, and it is more difficult than in other sciences to avoid fundamental questions because of the paucity of exact experimental knowledge. Nevertheless, something has been achieved, and much ancient error has been discarded. Much of this ancient error was associated with theology, either as cause or as effect. But the connection was not with particular texts or biblical errors of fact. It was rather with metaphysical doctrines which, for one reason or another, had come to be thought essential to the body of orthodox dogma. The soul, as it first appeared in Greek thought, had a religious origin. It seems to have originated in the Pythagoreans, who believed in transmigration, and aimed at an ultimate salvation which was to consist of liberation from the bondage of matter, which the soul must suffer so long as it is attached to a body. According to the philosophical orthodoxy of the Roman Catholic Church, soul and body are both substances. A substance is something other than the sum of its attributes. This appears most clearly in the Catholic doctrine of the Eucharist. In transubstantiation, the attributes of the bread remain, but the substance becomes that of the body of Christ. In the period of the rise of modern philosophy, all the innovators from Descartes to Leibniz, except Spinoza, took great pains to prove that their doctrines were consistent with transubstantiation. Take first the body. So long as the conception of substance was retained, the resurrection of the body meant the reassembling of the actual substance which had composed it when alive on earth. The substance might have passed through many transformations, but had retained its identity. If, however, a piece of matter is nothing but the assemblage of its attributes, its identity is lost when the attributes change, and there will be no sense in saying that the heavenly body, after the resurrection, is the same thing that was once an earthly body. This difficulty, oddly enough, is exactly paralleled in modern physics. An atom, with its attendant electrons, is liable to sudden transformations, and the electrons which appear after a transformation cannot be identified with those that had appeared before. Each is only a way of grouping observable phenomena, and has not the sort of reality required for the preservation of identity through change. The results of the abandonment of substance were even more serious as regards the soul than as regards the body. They showed themselves, however, very gradually, because various attenuated forms of the old doctrine were, for a time, thought to be still defensible. First, the word mind was substituted for the word soul in order to seem to avoid theological implications. Then the word subject was substituted, and this word still survives, particularly in the supposed contrast of subjective and objective. In human physiology, meanwhile, those who disliked materialism took refuge either in mystery or in the vital force. Some thought that science could never understand the human body. Others declared that it could only do so by invoking principles other than those of chemistry and physics. Neither of these views has now much popularity among biologists. The work which has been done in embryology, in biochemistry, and in the artificial production of organic compounds makes it more and more probable that the characteristics of living matter are wholly explicable in terms of chemistry and physics. As psychology and physics became more scientific, the traditional concepts of both gave way increasingly to new concepts capable of greater accuracy. Physics, until very recently, was content with matter and motion. But matter and motion have now been found inadequate, even technically, and the procedure of theoretical physicists has come much more into line with the demands of scientific philosophy. Psychology, in like manner, is finding it necessary to give up such concepts as perception and consciousness because it is found that they are incapable of precision. To make this plain, a few words about each will be necessary. Perception seems, at first sight, perfectly straightforward. We perceive the sun and moon, the words we hear spoken, the hardness or softness of the things we touch, the smell of a rotten egg, or the taste of mustard. There is no doubt about the occurrences of which we give this description. It is only the description that is questionable. When we perceive the sun, there has been a long causal process, first in the 93 million miles of intervening space, then in the eye, the optic nerve, and the brain. The final mental event, which we call seeing the sun, cannot be supposed to bear much resemblance to the sun itself. The sun remains outside our experience, and only to be known, if at all, by a difficult inference from the experience which we call seeing the sun. We suppose that the sun has an existence outside our experience, because many people see it at once, and because all sorts of things, such as the light of the moon, are most simply explained by assuming that the sun has effects in places where there are no observers. But we certainly do not perceive the sun in the direct and simple sense in which we seem to do so before we have realized the elaborate physical causation of sensations. To make inferences as to the object from the sort of experience which we naturally call a perception, we must know physics and the physiology of the sense organs, and we must have exhaustive information about what is in the intervening space between us and the object. Given all this information, and assuming the reality of the external world, we can derive some highly abstract information as to the object perceived. But all the warmth and immediacy that are implicit in the word perception will have vanished in this process of inference by means of difficult mathematical formulae. In the case of distant objects, like the sun, this is not difficult to see. But it is equally true of what we touch and smell and taste. Since our perception of such things is due to elaborate processes which travel along the nerves to the brain. The question of consciousness is perhaps rather more difficult. We say that we are conscious, but that sticks and stones are not. We say that we are conscious when awake, but not when asleep. We certainly mean something when we say this, and we mean something that is true. But to express with any accuracy what it is that is true is a difficult matter, and requires a change of language. When we say we are conscious, we mean two things. On the one hand, that we react in a certain way to our environment. On the other, that we seem to find, on looking within, some quality in our thoughts and feelings which we did not find in inanimate objects. The more important part of the notion of consciousness is concerned with what we discover by introspection. We not only react to external objects, but we know that we react. To know that we see something is not really a new piece of knowledge, over and above the seeing, unless it is a memory. If we first see something, and then immediately afterwards reflect that we say it, the reflection, which seems introspective, is an immediate memory. Memory, it may be said, is something distinctively mental, but this again may be denied. Memory is a form of habit, and habit is characteristic of nervous tissue, though it may occur elsewhere, for example in a roll of paper which rolls itself up again if it is unwound. Finally, it should be said that the old distinction between soul and body has evaporated quite as much as matter has lost its old solidity, as because mind has lost its spirituality. The data for both physics and psychology are events which, in some sense, happen in the brain. The facts which form the starting points of the two sciences are, at least in part, identical. It remains to inquire what bearing modern doctrines, as to physiology and psychology, have upon the credibility of the belief in immortality. What science has to say on the subject of immortality is not very definite. There is, indeed, one line of argument in favour of survival after death, which is, at least in intention, completely scientific. I mean the line of argument associated with the phenomena investigated by psychical research. I have not myself sufficient knowledge on this subject to judge of the evidence already available, but it is clear that there could be evidence which would convince reasonable people. The difficulty, for science, arises from the fact that there does not seem to be such an entity as the soul or self. As we saw, it is no longer possible to regard soul and body as two substances. Having that endurance through time, which metaphysicians regarded as logically bound up with the notion of substance. Nor is there any reason, in psychology, to assume a subject which, in perception, is brought into contact with an object. Until recently, it was thought that matter is immortal, but this is no longer assumed by the techniques of physics. An atom is now merely a convenient way of grouping certain occurrences. It is convenient, up to a point, to think of the atom as a nucleus with attendant electrons, but the electrons at one time cannot be identified with those at another, and in any case no modern physicist thinks of them as real. While there was still material substance which was supposed to be eternal, it was easy to argue that minds must be equally eternal. But this argument, which was never a very strong one, can now no longer be used. For sufficient reasons, physicists have reduced the atom to a series of events. For equally good reasons, psychologists find that a mind has not the identity of a single continuing thing, but is a series of occurrences bound together by certain intimate relations. The question of immortality, therefore, has become the question whether these intimate relations exist between occurrences connected with a living body and other occurrences which take place after that body is dead. We must decide, before we can attempt to answer this question, what are the relations which bind certain events together in such a way as to make the mental life of one person? Obviously, the most important of these is memory. Things that I can remember happened to me, and if I can remember a certain occasion, and on that occasion I could remember something else, then the something else also happened to me. Each person's experience is private to himself. And when one experience consists in recollecting another, the two are said to belong to the same person. There is another, less psychological definition of personality, which derives from the body. We can define a person as the series of mental occurrences connected with a given body. If John Smith's body committed a murder, and at a later time the police arrest John Smith's body, then the person inhabiting that body at the time of arrest is a murderer. These two ways of defining a person conflict in some cases with what is called dual personality. In such cases, what seems to outside observation to be one person is, subjectively, split into two. Sometimes neither knows anything of the other. Sometimes one knows the other, but not vice versa. In cases where neither knows anything of the other, there are two persons if memory is used as the definition, but only one if the body is used. There is a regular gradation to the extreme of dual personality through absent-mindedness, hypnosis, and sleepwalking. This makes a difficulty in using memory as the definition of personality, but it appears that lost memories can be recovered by hypnotism or in the course of psychoanalysis. Thus, perhaps, the difficulty is not insuperable. If we are to believe in the survival of a personality after the death of the body, we must suppose that there is continuity of memories, or at least of habits, since otherwise there is no reason to suppose that the same person is continuing. But at this point, physiology makes difficulties. Habit and memory are both due to effects on the body, especially the brain. The formation of a habit may be thought of as analogous to the formation of a watercourse. Now, the effects on the body which give rise to habits and memories are obliterated by death and decay, and it is difficult to see how, short of miracle, they can be transferred to a new body, such as we may be supposed to inhabit in the next life. If we are to be disembodied spirits, the difficulty is only increased. Indeed, I doubt whether, with modern views of matter, a disembodied spirit is logically possible. Matter is only a certain way of grouping events, and therefore, where there are events, there is matter. The continuity of a person throughout the life of his body, if, as I contend, it depends upon habit formation, must also depend upon the continuity of the body. I do not pretend that this argument is conclusive. It is impossible to foresee the future of science, particularly of psychology, which is only just beginning to be scientific. It may be that psychological causation can be freed from its present dependence on the body. But in the present state of psychology and physiology, belief in immortality can, at any rate, claim no support from science. And such arguments as are possible on the subject point to the probable extinction of personality at death.